and welcome back to PaleoCast. Over the next few days, we're going to be reporting almost live from the 4th International Paleontological Congress here in Mendoza, Argentina. IPC only happens once every 4 years and attracts delegates from all around the world. Every day, we're going to be releasing a whole suite of interviews, bringing the conference direct to you. The event is being held at the Sheraton Hotel in Mendoza, a city in the shadow of the Andes. It's a place most famous for its wine, and we even got a small bottle in our registration packs. We also got an official IPC4 soundtrack, which you're listening to right now. So, we hope you all enjoy our coverage, and, as always, please share us around social media, and even leave us a comment if there's anyone you'd like us to try and interview whilst we are here. We've got this fantastic opportunity to speak to so many paleontologists all in the one place, so just let us know. It's day one of our coverage of IPC4 here in Mendoza. So of course we're going to have to start with some South American animals. In front of me we've got a poster on the Xenarthra, and we've also got Francois Puot here. Could you tell us all about your research?
Well, I am working on South American endemic mammals, and especially sloths and ground sloths. And it was a very good opportunity during the EPC in Argentina to present some researches on the origin of modern tree sloths. Because nowadays it's possible to see in Amazonas some very peculiar mammals who are the tree sloths, who are living almost all the time in the trees. And we are finding in all America its cousins, who are the ground sloths, and some problems in to find the relationships between the modern tree sloths and the ground sloths. And it's a very interesting problematic.
So what's the difference between the modern tree sloths and the older relatives?
Well, we know that they are in the same big clad group of the sloths, but they are completely different. The ground sloths was a very giant mammals, between 50 kilos and 4 tons, and they were gravigrada. They were walking on the ground and not living in the trees like the modern tree sloths. Well, they were completely different. And during one event of the evolution of ground sloths, some of them are moving in the trees, and now they are the only representative of the sloths. All the ground sloths have disappeared.
So why do we think that the tree sloths survived and the other ones disappeared?
Well, they are survived in relation with a very peculiar environment that we could find in the Amazonas. And but we don't know the origin of the tree sloths. We know they have a diphyletic origin. They have obtaining the same kind of locomotion by convergence, but they are the two only representatives of all big group of mammals who were living in South America during almost 40 million years old.
And is it the same for all the South American mammals, that they are very different now to what they were in the past?
Yes, they were very different. The only similarity are in relation with the skulls and the teeth, but they have a lot of modification of the limbs in relation to this very peculiar kind of locomotion. They are completely different anatomically to the ground sloths. That's why it's so difficult for us, the paleontologists, to find a phylogenetic relationship between them.
Okay. But the other animals in the Xenarthra group, are they all different as well?
Yes, but nowadays you have three big groups of Xenarthra: the armadillos, the vermilingua or anteaters, and the sloths. The fossils of the anteaters and the armadillos are very similar. You can see the evolution very easily. They have not changed a lot. You know that the older Xenarthra, it's an armadillo of 50 million years old, and very similar to the modern armadillos. The sloths, they are completely different. That's why it's so difficult to find their origin.
And so what next for research into sloths?
Well, I'm working in sloths since 15 years. Now I'm working in other groups of endemic mammals. And all the South American mammals are very interesting because like Australia or Madagascar, you have an endemic evolution of these mammals. That's why they are so strange.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So someone that we've mentioned a couple of times on Paleocast but never had the honour of interviewing is Aubrey Roberts, who's of the University of Southampton and of the Natural History Museum in Oslo. So Aubrey, you're part of Jørn Hurum's research group. What have you guys been doing?
Well, at the moment we're just trying to finish the Jurassic project because we're starting on the Triassic, which will be also awesome.
So the Jurassic one was where you guys were in Svalbard digging up marine reptiles. Is it just the same thing, but just a bit earlier?
Yes, basically the same thing. Different weird things in the Triassic though compared to the Jurassic. But we still got lots of new species to describe from the Jurassic that we excavated over the past 10 years, so we've got to get that sorted out first.
Yeah, it's quite a backlog.
Yeah, there's an enormous backlog. It's because it takes so long to prepare them, so that's why.
Okay, but you're already started to go out and find some new specimens.
Yeah, that takes time too, so got to be prepared.
But it's more fun, of course.
True.
So, have you found any new ones?
In the Jurassic or the Triassic?
Both.
Both. Well, at the moment we're describing two new species of plesiosauroid, so long-necked plesiosaur.
Right.
And some new species of ichthyosaur as well from the Jurassic. In the Triassic, we're not sure what we've got yet. We've got a whole load of weird things, so we'll see when it gets back from the ship.
So you've found something, but no idea what it is.
Yeah, basically. No idea.
Okay, because I think I remember Jørn saying that you had to plaster cast them and then leave them a couple of years to dry out?
Minimum of 6 months, but they usually, because of the backlog, get left for years. But the material that we collected from the Triassic this year was just surface material because we didn't have permission to dig. We'll get that next year because it takes a long time to apply for that sort of thing. So, yeah.
Yeah, because you got to apply to the... Because Svalbard's all protected, isn't it?
Yeah, the governor of Svalbard is the person you got to apply to.
And you had to prove first that you could find fossils before you could start digging?
Basically, we had to have the GPS points of where we were going to dig, so had to look for it first.
And so how long did you spend out there looking?
About 2 weeks.
That's not too long. I mean, was that 2 weeks before you found anything, or the actual field season was 2 weeks?
The actual field season was 2 weeks. Basically, about within an hour of arriving at the field site, they found some ichthyosaurs. So it was, we found everything we needed to find in the first 3 days, and then the rest was just fun.
So when you went out there, did you actually know that there'd be anything?
People had told us that there wasn't anything out there. But we wanted to check and we found lots, so yeah.
Excellent. Well, I think we'll have to catch up with you again in 6 months plus.
Yeah, in about a year probably.
All right, thank you very much. So we've got Robin Dahl of the University of California with a poster on the paleoecology of Ordovician gastropods from the Great Basin in the USA. So could you give us basically the lowdown on your research?
Yeah, so I've been looking at Ordovician gastropods for mainly because not really anyone else does that. If you were to read the literature on the Ordovician and the ecology of the Ordovician, you would get the impression that snails were not present or of essentially no ecological importance. But once you set foot on the outcrop and start to look at the rocks, you find that gastropods and snails are actually very common and in fact dominate some ecosystems. So they're a much bigger part of the Ordovician story than they're given credit for. And the other thing that I've been doing is taking a different tack than a lot of people who have looked at Ordovician gastropods, because much of the work has been done on isolated museum specimens that lack any sort of environmental context. So I've been reanalyzing the sedimentology and approaching this from the field rather than the collections to try and get a more well-rounded picture of Ordovician gastropod radiation during this time period.
So.
So what kind of environments do they actually occupy in the Ordovician? Is it basically all the marine ones?
Well, the Great Basin, my field area, is essentially a big carbonate platform. So I've, in this project, only been looking at carbonate environments. But in the carbonate environments, yes, they're everywhere. And the kind of weird thing that I've been noticing is that they're dominant in sort of the harsher, more restricted environments, like low oxygen basin floor or hypersaline lagoon, and environments that other more typical Ordovician fauna are less don't do as well in.
So do you think that could be a reason why they're so resilient?
Possibly. That's something that I'm trying to sort out and trying to quantify. So I'm working on that.
So where will your research go from now? What are you planning to look at next?
This is a pretty... There's a lot here that I still need to sort out. But what I would like to do is to push this up the time scale a little bit and see, because there was a big extinction at the end of the Ordovician, and see how they fare through the extinction and the recovery during the Silurian, the next period. So I'd like to see how this story progresses through time.
Lovely. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks.
Right, so we got Claire Browning, who works for the Council of Geoscience in South Africa. Oh, that was a good start. In Cape Town. So could you tell us a bit about your job and what you look at?
Sure. I'm a geologist, so I kind of look at the sedimentary environments. So, but I have a bit of a background in paleontology, so I'm looking at that as well in conjunction. That's why the Sturm Shale and the Cederberg, at least, formation is pretty interesting to me, both sedimentologically as well as paleontologically.
So can you give us a brief overview of the Sturm Shale?
Sure. Well, it's the basal unit, the contact, is with the Pakes Formation, which is basically a glacial diamictite. And it's situated in the Aeschylean age, so it's in the Ordovician glacial event. And then related to that is obviously the extinctions. So the Pakes is our diamictite, and then it goes into the Sturm member, which is a carbonaceous sort of shale member, and then it grades upwards into the Dicer, which is a much coarser grained facies. And most of the important fossil finds are really found in the shale, as would be expected, I guess. Yeah.
Okay, so painting a picture, it's a pretty cold environment, pretty quiet. Is it anoxic?
The idea is that it is. There's localized mineralization of the fossils, and Sarah Gabbett has done some really cool work because you get a lot of preservation, amazing preservation, up to the preservation of muscle fibers. And the idea is that it's direct mineralization, preserving that amazing replication. So, yeah.
So is that pyrite?
There definitely is a lot of sulfide pyrites within the shales, but there's a very interesting sort of microcosm of surrounding fossils. So it's not a sort of classic example of a completely pyritic. You know.
Okay, so it's not like golden fossils.
No, not at all. No.
Okay, so what kind of fossils do we actually get there?
There's a whole host of fossils. It's a lagostrata, so it's incredibly well preserved. So we have everything from sort of bromelites to amazing conodont fossils, which is what the Sturm is so famous for, really. It was the first place where the conodont animal was actually described. They found the tooth elements, and they didn't really know where they came from or what they were, and then they just discovered a almost complete skeleton of conodonts. Specifically the eyes were really well preserved.
Yeah, it had pretty big eyes, didn't it?
It did, huge eyes. Sumepsis, that's that dude there. Very cool, and then you have little trilobites, and we have really good record of Eurypterids as well. And the conodonts are really big, so there's a gigantism element going on as well.
Okay, so what kind of geological questions are you asking of the Sturm Shale?
Well, at the moment, it's a very preliminary study that we're doing, and we're trying to understand the interplay between biology and geology, really. So we're trying to understand how algal material becomes associated with coarse-grained sediments within the fine-grained mud rock. Yeah.
Right, any ideas? And what is the significance?
Well, trying to understand post-glacial environments, especially connected to the indoor division extinction event, would be pretty useful, sort of globally. But also, South Africa hasn't really been that well studied in terms of the sedimentology, I would say. So to try and tie it in to a much bigger idea in Gondwana would be great. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay.
We have Tatsuo Oji from Nagoya University, who's got a poster on the penetrative trace fossil Aranicolites from the late Ediacaran of Western Mongolia. So, as I think I remember that the Ediacaran-Cambrian boundary is based on trace fossils. So the fact that we're getting these trace fossils in the Ediacaran, that's pretty new and significant, isn't it?
Yeah, formerly people think that the Ediacaran trace fossil is horizontal, not penetrating vertically, and size is small compared with the Cambrian trace fossils. But we found first evidence of penetrative trace fossil Aranicolites. This picture shows a penetrating burrow down to maximum 4 centimeters from the surface. Apparently, the animal at the Ediacaran time has burrows penetrating vertically down the sediments. And also the size is big. The diameter is up to 1 centimeter. So at that time, before the Cambrian, at the late Ediacaran time, animals is large enough and penetrated downwards and mixing the sediments. So this is the first evidence, I think.
So does this change our understanding of the Ediacaran-Cambrian boundary? Are we going to have to move it to a later time?
Well, Cambrian, pre-Cambrian boundary is based on the first appearance of particular trace fossil Trepidicus pedum, and that trace fossil occurs well above the sequence, 200 meters above the sequence than the present Aranicolites horizon. So we are pretty sure that these are before the PCC boundary, namely Precambrian-Cambrian boundary. But we are now checking isotope evidence from the carbon isotope. So after getting the carbon isotope data, we will publish the results.
Okay. And where did you find these fossils? Are they in Japan?
We don't have any rocks of this age, so we have to go abroad to study this. So I have to go to Western Mongolia or China to study Cambrian and Ediacaran things.
And do you think you'll find any other kind of typical Cambrian fossils in the Ediacaran in these rocks?
Well, I haven't seen any typical Cambrian things in the Ediacaran, but maybe the results of the location, paleolocation of Mongolia, because Mongolia is located near the equator, so there may be early evolution than the Newfoundland. It's a typical Cambrian section.
So that's where you have a mistaken point.
Yeah, in comparison with mistaken points, this may be an earlier evolution of animals than mistaken points. So we have also compared the sizes or density of ichnofossils, trace fossils from Newfoundland and Mongolian sections. And Mongolian section has an early diversification, early proliferations of ichnofossils than Newfoundland in a very high Arctic zones, cold environments.
So do you think that it was that these creatures that formed the trace fossils evolved in Mongolia or towards the equator,
yeah,
and then moved towards Newfoundland?
Yes.
Or could it be the case that the rocks are different between the two, and that the kind of creatures that made these trace fossils preferred the habitat that they had?
It's difficult to say which is the correct scenario, but we think that early diversification occurred in the tropical zone and migrated into a higher latitude later. The similar trend is exactly we found in higher latitude in Newfoundland. So the same thing happens later, not independently occurring the same phenomena later.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for listening.
So we've got Joanna Wolf from the American Museum of Natural History. Joe, could you tell us what you work on?
Hi, I work on reconstructing the Tree of Life, especially in arthropods. And I am interested in the evolution of metamorphosis. So like when you see a butterfly go from a caterpillar to a pupa to a butterfly, I do that but with marine animals, which have larval stages that live in the open ocean as plankton. And those stages look totally different from the adults. So what's really cool is that in the fossil record, we have examples of some of those forms dating back all the way to the Cambrian 500 million years ago. So I work on incorporating those fossils into the Tree of Life that we already know from living crustaceans.
So we already know that animals change throughout their ontogeny, how they grow.
Right.
So why is there a problem fitting them on the Tree of Life? Why don't we just use their adult form?
Well, in terms of fossils, the adult form is not preserved in a lot of cases, so you don't have that information. If you make a comparison between a larva and an adult, they're not going to have very many similarities. Similarly, I'm also working on molecular data that to look at the same kind of problem, and the genes in the nucleus of your cell are always the same. But your cell needs to use different genes at different times in your life. Think about hormones, like in an adolescent human, for example. They have different hormones than we do as adults, thank God. So I also look at whether the expression of different genes changing through ontogeny is affecting phylogenetic reconstruction.
Okay, so basically, is there an issue with these animals that change throughout their growth, fitting them on the tree? Can we work out a way of standardizing these kind of animals that change?
It's challenging. What I would recommend is using as much data as possible from the stages that you can. In terms of, part of the issue is also that they have different numbers of stages sometimes. So it can get quite complicated if you have something with four stages and something with six. Standardizing that can be tricky. So yeah, I would recommend incorporating as much data as possible.
Do you think there's many animals, many fossils that we know of that may actually be the same species? We just got a juvenile and an adult form.
That is quite possible, and in a fossil, I think it's going to be extremely difficult to reconcile that. One possible way is if you perhaps have an actual fossil of one molting into another. There are examples, very rare, but there are examples of fossils in the middle of a molt, so theoretically you could see something like that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we've got Krista Smith of the Senckenberg Museum in Frankfurt, and you are working on the Messel Shale.
That's right. Messel is something of an iconic fossil site. It has fossils of really astonishing completeness. When I was a graduate student working on fossils, I was happy that I could carry around thousands of fossils in a tiny little jar and had a very, very large sample size. Messel doesn't produce a lot of fossils, but the fossils that it does produce are really marked by their extraordinary preservation. The fossils fell into a Messel. Messel is essentially a small little basin that formed as a result of a kind of volcanic eruption during the Middle Eocene time, 48 million years ago, and it very quickly filled with water and became a lake. Now, because of the structure of the lake, the stratification of the water column, there was very little oxygen at the base of the lake. And because of this, fossils that fell into it decayed very slowly over many thousands of years and led to the extraordinary preservation that we see there.
Okay, so a fossil lake, is it things like fish that we get preserved then?
the diversity of organisms that are preserved in Mesol is perhaps as astonishing as the preservation of those organisms themselves. There's a huge variety of plants that are found there, everything from ferns to a very large diversity of angiosperms. We see an extraordinary number of insects, as well as many, many vertebrates as well, fish, amphibians, reptiles, mammals, and birds as well.
So lots of things that didn't actually live in the lake got washed in and then preserved.
That's exactly right. There's the precise reason that, or the means by which many of these organisms ended up at the bottom of the lake is still a matter of discussion and controversy. Nevertheless, it seems clear that now and then organisms died and got washed into the lake or fell into the lake and eventually sank to the bottom.
Okay, so when was Mesol first discovered?
The fact that the landscape historically was completely flat, or perhaps even a little bit boggy or marshy. They ran a railroad line through it in the middle part of the 19th century, and you can see that the railroad line skirted around this area because it was not suitable for running locomotives across. There are a couple of stories about how oil shale was first discovered. One of them is that there was a hunter and his companions who were there working in the forest shooting foxes, and they found a little fox den, and they were trying to dig the fox out of its den, and they realized that the rock that they were digging through was very, very soft shale as opposed to hard sandstone like in the surroundings. And then that was brought to for analyses, and one realized that there were a lot of organic compounds in the shale. The other story is that there were some woodsmen working in the woods, and it was in the middle of the winter, and they lit a fire to keep themselves warm, and the fire didn't go out. It kept burning into the rock, which then of course attracted attention, and they realized that, oh, we have a lot of organic compounds here in the shale. And originally people were very excited about this. It was called lignite, sort of, I don't know what a colloquial term for lignite is.
Lignite? Yep.
People said, wow, there's lignite here. This will secure our futures and the futures of our children's children through mining here. Turns out it wasn't lignite, and it wasn't suitable for burning as people had expected. And it wasn't until a very innovative chemist came along that he brought the mining operation into full steam.
So then it was mined for the oil that it had in it?
That's correct.
Was that when they started to find the fossils?
That's right. They first started mining it for these compounds, especially white paraffin and mineral oil were able to be extracted from the oil shale. The first report of any fossil from Mesol is in 1876. Somebody found a part of a crocodile. This is not surprising. It's a large organism. It's obvious when you see it. But doubtlessly during the first decades of the mining operation, they were finding plants and other things. But none of them were really conserved until the 1960s, when new methods were invented to be able to conserve these fossils. It's quite difficult at Mesol because the oil shale is called an oil shale, and the water content of the oil shale is 40, even 50%. It means if you take a piece of this oil shale with a fossil on it outside of the bedrock and you expose it to the atmosphere, it begins to crumble very quickly and the fossil is very rapidly destroyed. But in the 1960s, people developed new methods for conserving these things on epoxy plates or in glycerin, and that's when the paleontological research at Mesol really took off.
So what's the significance of the fossils that we find in Mesol?
The time frame that Mesol represents is interesting in the history of life. Everybody knows that the big dinosaurs went extinct at the end of the Cretaceous, that ecosystems were devastated around the world, and is in the early part of the Cenozoic, starting at 65 million years ago when the ecosystems were essentially recovering from this mass extinction. The life was proliferating, but among new groups. The mammals were diversifying rapidly. Also among reptiles, lizards and snakes are diversifying. And so what we're looking at Mesa is the early stages of this diversification process that we see during the Cenozoic. Another interesting aspect of Mesel is that it records a time period which is referred to as the Eocene climate optimum. Temperatures were at a maximum level from the last 65 million years. The climate, even in middle and high latitudes, was quite warm. The forests that we see in Germany, well, what today is Germany, look nothing like the modern forests. They look much more similar to something that you might see in Southeast Asia today. So we're looking at an ecosystem the likes of which does not exist anymore. We have very strong seasonal cycles in terms of light and dark, but nevertheless the temperature was much more warm and homogeneous. And to look at the ecological interactions among these species to try to understand what they were like at the time is something that, well, Mesel gives us a unique perspective on that.
Well, what kind of things can you work out about their ecology?
First of all, on the basis of the complete preservation that we see in these things, we can understand much, much better what these animals actually did in life by looking at the entire body. Furthermore, in some of these specimens here record ecological interactions within themselves. You can see from a specimen, for instance, that we pulled out a couple of years ago of a snake. And inside of the snake, in the belly of the snake, is a lizard. And inside the belly of the lizard is a beetle. So what we see in this single specimen is a three-link food chain. But it doesn't stop there either, because if you were just to look at this snake, you wouldn't have a very good idea of where the snake was living. However, on the basis of studies of this lizard, we're reasonably confident that this lizard lived in the trees. And if the lizard lived in the trees, then we can also be reasonably confident that the snake was living in the trees as well. So the interactions among the species, where they were living, and how they parsed their environment, how they inhabited their environment, all of this is on display at Mesa.
So is the entire site being managed in any way? Is it being looked after?
Mesel has a very long and complicated administrative history. It's owned by many different concerns or groups throughout its history. Since the early 90s, the Zenkenberg Museum is responsible for the administration of the site. There are a lot of complicated issues with the management. Because it's a former strip mine, it falls under German mining law, and all of this has to be accounted for. There are dangers in the pit itself, slumping. There are active slumps in the pit, and one has to be concerned about where one's digging. You can't simply go to a site and, oh, let's dig here. Because one has to be, you know, is this site slumping? Could it slump? Fires are an issue. Smoking and all other forms of fire are forbidden in the pit precisely because you could ignite a slow and long burning fire which may take years to extinguish. And so there are a number of complex issues that attend the excavations there. Nevertheless, there are a number of active sites, and there are ways that we're looking at excavating it in the future to get at new horizons that haven't yet been sampled.
Do you have any idea how much is actually left in Mesel then of this ancient lake?
Well, it's a very interesting question. Certainly the German government would like to have some idea of how long they're supposed to continue funding excavations. And through recently developed biodiversity theoretic techniques, we can actually kind of get quantitative estimates of what the biodiversity of Mesel was and how long it will take us to sample a specified percentage of that diversity. And the results that we've come to suggest that in order to get at 80% of the diversity of Mesa, we would have to continue digging for essentially another generation to double our sample size.
And there's enough rock there to do that?
There's enough rock there to do that. I don't know how many millions of cubic meters of rock they removed in the first century of mining there, but we're moving at a much slower pace, splitting the shale layer by layer, and new species keep turning up. And as I said, we expect that to be so. We expect Mesa to provide new species for another generation at least.
What are some of the big finds to come out of Mesa?
The specimens from Mesa are spectacular in a number of different ways. And so if I were to try to choose what specimens are most spectacular, we'd have to go in several different directions. There are obviously some specimens which are very beautiful or very interesting to the casual observer. For instance, these enormous bees which were at Mesa with a wingspan of 5 inches. This is a British thing, so 5-inch wingspan, or specimens which show a kind of mimicry in which they're trying to look like leaves in order to camouflage themselves. We also see the preservation of original color of these fossils at Mesa, either the structural color, the so-called structural color, which is embedded in the fine scale surface of the fossils, or of the original pigments which are preserved in there. And so the preservation of Mesa allows us to reconstruct, for instance, what colors a moth had when it was in life. We also see samples of spectacular ecological preservation, like the snake that I mentioned with the lizard in its belly and the insect in the belly of the lizard. We see there's a horse, a very primeval horse, maybe the size of a dog, which was a female horse, and it was pregnant at the time that it fell into the lake. And so we see the fetus, which is still preserved in its belly. Another really fantastic fossil, which was described only 2 years ago, I think, was of a turtle species. Now, it had long been known that this turtle species tends to occur in pairs in the site. And it turns out that careful biometric studies of these turtle pairs showed that they're always male and female, and they always have their back ends pressed to each other. And it looks like these turtles died in the process of copulation. Very likely they were doing this in the water. That's what their modern relatives do. They sank in the water column somewhat during the procedure, and they sank too deep. They got down into the carbon dioxide-rich layers of the lake, absorbed the carbon dioxide across their soft tissues, and were asphyxiated. And once they died, they very quickly then sank to the bottom. So the copulating turtles of Mesa are also a pretty spectacular find.
All right, Krista, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at Paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.